Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, presenting Urbana Uncorked, a special wine tasting event to benefit WILL AM-FM TV on Friday, April 21st from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines, many not readily available in central Illinois, will be featured along with door prizes, a silent auction, and more. Tickets available at the door or at the Corkscrew, 337-7704.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. We're also pleased in this first hour of the show to talk with Paul Krugman. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's also professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. He joined the Times in 1999 as a columnist on the op-ed page, and he is now in the paper twice a week. He's also written for other publications, including Fortune and Slate, the Harvard Business Review, Foreign Policy, The Economist, Harper's, and Washington Monthly. He is the author or editor of 20 and more than 200 papers in professional journals and edited volumes. If you're interested in reading a sampling of some of his columns, you can look for a book which collects them. It's entitled The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. It's available in a paper published by W.W. Norton. I also would like to mention two other books. These are economic textbooks, which he has co-authored, that are introductory books. One of them is titled Macroeconomics, and the other is Microeconomics, and it's published. They're published by Wirth. And the reason that I mention them is that I think that if there were people who were interested in getting a better understanding of basic economics, they are books that I think almost anybody could read and afterwards feel that perhaps they understood economic issues a little better. Certainly, Mr. Krugman has written for other economists, but has been praised for writing about economic issues in a way that makes them accessible to people who are not economists. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if people have questions, they're certainly welcome to call. Professor Krugman, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure.
We appreciate it. You know, I think that I would freely admit that on that long list of things that I would say I don't really understand, economics is right up at the top, along with things like particle physics and the Big Bang theory. So I guess my question is, I'm sure that I'm not alone, and the question is, why is it, do you think, that for so many people, economics and economic issues are so difficult for them to grasp?
Well, one thing is that it is. There is some technical stuff you sometimes need to know, but I think mostly it's mostly the confusion is spread deliberately. It's a little bit like, if I can say, a theory of evolution, where it really isn't a very confusing subject, except a lot of people want to make it one. So there's an awful lot of disinformation out there about economics.
Well, that then maybe gets to a question about economists, and I think there again, the popular perception is that while on the one hand we have a field that seems to be about numbers, about reducing economic realities to some kind of formulas that will allow you to describe what's going on and make predictions. Having said that, I think people also have this perception that if you get five economists together in the room and you ask them a question, you'll get 10 opinions. And it is something that it seems on the one hand to be such a matter of solid numbers, and on the other, there's something mysterious going on that would lead different economists to give you different answers to the same question.
Okay, a couple of things. One is that forecasting what the economy is going to do next month is really hard. Mm-hmm. It's like weather prediction, only more so. The economy is just very complicated. Knowing what's going to happen in the very near future there are people who make highly educated guesses, but it's not surprising there's a lot of disagreement about that. For the other stuff, there's some real disagreement, but a lot of it is manufactured. Mm. So, I can tell you, if I'm writing for tomorrow's New York Times, I'm writing a piece about about tax cuts. And if you ask the question, how much did the Bush tax cuts favor the rich? Now, if you were to read what people who say they're economists say, you'd think there was vast dispute about that it was all over the place. But in fact, there isn't. In fact, you can figure out that the administration's own numbers pretty much agree with the liberal think tanks that say that, you know, about 40% of the cuts are going to the richest 1%. What's happened is that it's all buried under spin because economics is a very political subject, and the truth is sometimes just very inconvenient and gets buried.
Well, one, I have already starting to get some callers, and I want to make sure we give plenty of people a chance to talk with you. But then let me ask again one other kind of basic and large question. When things are going well in the economy, the president, the administration, the Congress, they all like to take credit. And when things are going badly, they are blamed. The big question is, the president and the Congress, just how much kind of influence do they have over the economy?
Most of the time, very little. The difference between a mild recession and a pretty good recovery has got almost nothing to do with who's in the White House. Has a lot to do with who's running the Federal Reserve. Sometimes, but not much. I mean, mainly, what you're worried about in terms of economic management is you're worried about longer term trends, which can be influenced a lot by whether the government runs a responsible budget, whether the government invests in things like education and infrastructure. And in real crises, that's when you really need people who know what they're doing. It did make a lot of difference that we replaced Herbert Hoover with Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. So that under those circumstances, it matters. If you ask the question, would the growth rate of real gross domestic product have been a whole lot different if the ballots in Palm Beach hadn't been so confusing in 2000. And I'm not sure I can make that case.
Well, then one other question then about deficits, and this again seems to be something that on which economists will differ. Do deficits matter?
Yeah, of course they matter. I mean, among other things, there's no question that in the end, the government has to pay its bills. So governments cannot run deficits forever, even the U.S. government. There's a real disagreement about how severe the consequences are. And the reason for that is because we're in uncharted territory. We've never had a country this big, this rich, with this good a reputation from the past, act this irresponsibly. So the question, you know, if we saw the numbers that the U.S. has right now and the name of our country was Argentina, everyone would agree that a crisis was just over the horizon. Because it's America, we think we have more leeway, and the question is how much, and we don't know about that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Paul Krugman. He's an op-ed columnist for The New York Times, has been now since 1999. He also teaches economics and international affairs at Princeton. And questions are certainly welcome. We have several people who are ready to go. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go to Indiana for the first call. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. That last statement leads into my question where you talked about we're in uncharted territory because no country's had these statistics, but as large as we are and as powerful, which makes me think that what I was going to ask about is the mathematics. In physics, oftentimes experimental stuff finally gets placed into a general theory because a mathematician has come up with a new mathematics. And it allows closer tolerance for the tests and stuff and percentage for statistical stuff. And I just think economics is hampered by mathematics, and nobody's come up yet with something to take care of these situations. You shouldn't have to say statements like, well, this is a new, powerful country, and these things have never been experienced before. If it were mathematics, you know, just strictly mathematics, you know, bang, 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 you know, it wouldn't make a difference if it's a little country or big country or several countries, you know. And I think that's the place where when I listen to people such as you and really people with degrees can give you, as David said in the beginning, can give you various stories about how to fit all these things together. And unfortunately, nobody ever comes up and says, that group over there has been right 17% of the time. The other groups have been right 10% or however it would go. So the public could, you know, listen to somebody and have some idea that they're actually know what the hell they're talking about. Thank you.
Okay. The quick comment here. This you know, economists, serious economists, know more math than I'd like to even describe. It's not that easy. And a good parallel on this stuff would be climate change. Which is based on physics, trying to analyze global warming, how fast it's going to proceed, how big it's going to go, and there are physics principles and there's mathematics and there's a lot of number crunching that goes into these things, but there's still a very wide range of estimates, even among the people who are honestly doing the research about, you know, how much global warming we're going to have in the next century, and there's a and then you've got people out there very noisily denying that there's going to be any, because there are people with an ideological or a financial stake in denying the science such as it is, and that's economics is a lot like that. It's a very complex system, more complex, of course, even than the global climate, because we're dealing with people, which are the most complex things we know. There are track records. There are things you can say that some people have been, always wrong, and there's a lot that we do know. Particularly when I started writing for the New York Times, I started to realize just how important it is to just talk about their basic arithmetic, just the 2 + 2 = 4, because there's a lot of people out there in political life who will insist time and again that 2 - 1 = 5, and just by pointing that out, you can already become deeply controversial.
Well, let's go on and talk with some other folks. Next, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Not to be fulsome, Mr. Krugman, I read all your columns. I think there's nobody with your level of social awareness or expertise writing it at this point that I've encountered. But I wonder if, as you see it, or to what extent, if any, you could characterize the United States economic system, political system, as a crooked card game, in that the economic elite, to use a quotation marks term, have so much power that democracy or the people's interests have become irrelevant. That is to say, this concentration of wealth distorts the whole system with respect to, like, individual rights and economic justice. Would you care to address that, please?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. I think that's overstating the case. We're not there yet, but I worry that we might be going there. I mean, we certainly have a situation in which one man, one vote is not entirely a fiction, but is certainly misleading. If you look at a lot of the policies, they do tilt towards the interests of the extremely well-off. We know that there's a lot of corruption and fraud in our corporate institutions. I've seen genuinely thoroughly corrupt systems, third world, Indonesia, and we're not there yet, but we're certainly not the wonderful Norman Rockwell democracy we like to imagine ourselves to be. There is you can look at the horrible bankruptcy bill that Congress passed last year. That was an example of something that everybody, I think, knew was a quite vicious, poorly designed, would hurt the most vulnerable people, and yet it was completely unstoppable in Congress because of the power of money, essentially the lobbying of the credit card companies. That sort of thing happens, but the thing to do is not to just sort of despair and say, well, nothing less than a bloody revolution will turn it around, because we're still a reformable society.
I wonder if I could follow up, sir.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To what extent, then, it seems to me that the trend is towards a further and further concentration of wealth and power, among, I don't know, like I said, this elite.
Yeah.
Do you see a counter trend?
Well, I think what we look for is a great political backlash.
Uh-huh. Okay?
My parallel is the U.S. in a lot of ways now looks like the U.S. in the 20s. Mm. We've got this rapidly growing inequality. We've got a political system that's heavily money-dominated. But during the 20s, there were reformists out there. They were not getting enough traction to win a national election, but they were able to do things in particular places. And given the opportunity, given a really big stumble by the moneyed elite, we got Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. And that really did change things. I mean, America became a much better place and a much more, much more of a community, a shared society with shared prosperity and shared values because of Franklin Roosevelt. And that lasted for about 50 years. If anybody's got a candidate for the next Franklin Roosevelt, let me know about it. But I think we can do that again.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I think that some people would argue that part of the problem is that for those people who are maybe struggling, people who are in the middle, that they tend sometimes to identify up rather than to identify down.
Yes, I'm trying to make this point, and we'll continue to make it that's a very great misconception that people have. What's been happening in our society is not that the poor are falling behind the rest of us. Actually, what's been happening for the past 25 years is that a very small number of very well-off people are pulling away from everybody else, the middle class and the poor combined. And there's a lot of the misconception people have is that they have no idea just how many privileges have been given to the top 1%, the top 10th of a percent of the population. They get more exercised over the idea that some person is getting an extra $500 more than he should on the earned income tax credit than at the idea that somebody with an income of $10 million a year is underpaying his taxes by $1 million. And that's something that we need a little bit of class warfare in our society. It's just to get people alerted to the truth.
Let's talk with another caller. This is Urbana, and it's line 3. Hello.
Yeah, I heard most of your lecture on campus here about the healthcare system.
And yeah,
that was an excellent lecture. It was just too bad I had to cut out right at the end. But and you made a point about the kind of a class warfare kind of point when you said that high technology and medical technology can actually kill people because it sucks up resources. But anyway, I hope you get to talk about the VA system before you're off today, because it's really an important topic. But I wanted to ask you something more to do with the general idea of the economic theory and where it is in the standing, etc. And I'm going to take off from a article by Moises Naim in Foreign Policy currently.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but yeah.
Yeah, he says that he points out how Cardoso in Brazil had to ignore all these economic Nobel laureates, etc., their advice, and that by ignoring it, and he's a sociologist, that he managed to steer Brazil out of its crisis, financial crisis, and he's talking about how the economic theory is really in a dismal state. But he highlights someone I've never heard of, Albert O. Hirschman.
Oh, yeah.
And he says that one of his books, Essays in Trespassing, should be looked into. But I'm just wondering if you could, if you would endorse that, that it would be great to have somebody other than to read than just the one New York Times columnist. So you, yeah. Namely. So if you could talk a little bit about that, I'd appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay. I actually did a lot in my professional life on financial crises in third world countries. That's actually one of the things I've spent a lot of time working on, and those are hard. That's one of those areas where there is a legitimate confusion. You know, there isn't actually. We don't know for sure what the answers are. For what it's worth, I don't know how I avoid. Not only like I'm patting myself on the back, my own track record is pretty good at calling them. The thing in Brazil was that there were some people who were telling Brazil that it had to do these terrible austerity, that they really had to punish themselves to avoid crisis, and it turned out that that was wrong. But it wasn't by any means unanimous. I mean, in fact, they were able to. There were plenty of good economists giving them good advice. And the problem is, how do you know which is which? But those are really hard cases. The big thing I think you have to beware if you're. Particularly if you're for people like the places in Brazil or Argentina, is that there a lot of the, which you might call, you know, North American economists who come there come with an ideological agenda. We're going to make you over into a free market society. We're going to reinvent you as what we wish the United States was, although it isn't actually. And that warped a lot of the advice. They were being told that you have to be super careful about balancing your budget when that wasn't. It isn't always the most important thing. People were told that they had to put controlling inflation absolutely as the top priority when, you know, there are other things you need to take account of. The Argentines are very mad at U.S.-based economists with good reason, because they've got a lot of very bad advice. But for what it's worth, I gave them good advice. It's just that it didn't actually and I called the crisis well in advance, so these are hard issues, but not everybody's wrong.
I know that you have a lot of admirers and are well known for having been critical of the Bush administration and its policies. I guess I'm interested, though, in the question, is it possible for an economist not to have some kind of ideological bias? I suppose some people would say, well, you have an ideological bias as well.
Oh, everyone does. But you try to watch yourself. If you've reached a conclusion, you should always say to yourself, "Am I getting there because this is really where the evidence and the analysis leads, or am I saying this because it makes me feel comfortable?" And you know that's not a perfect thing, but you really have to try. And look, there's an issue here where I've come out. With some negative thoughts about immigration, and that's where happens to be an issue where my emotional and, if you like, my ideological biases are all basically pro-immigrant. But I just have to say to myself, aren't there really some significant downsides for the U.S. economy? And you try to face up. And what I really despise are people who give in without question to believing what they want to believe, rather than always challenging themselves to ask themselves, is this really right?
Well, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Paul Krugman. He is an op-ed columnist for The New York Times and also is professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton. He is the author of many books and articles and appeared in professional journals and edited volumes. So he's written a lot for other economists. But as I mentioned at the beginning, I think a lot of people really think that he does a good job at writing about economic issues in ways that people who are not economists can get them. He is a specialist in his professional work in areas of international trade and finance. He's written for a number of publications in addition to The Times, including Fortune and Slate, The Harvard Business Review, Foreign Policy, The Economist, Harper's, and Washington Monthly. If you're interested in sampling some of his recent writing for The New York Times, you can look for the book The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. It's now out in paper, and it's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome here on our program, 333-9455. For Champaign Urbana listeners, we do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll go on next to someone in a nearby community of Belgium, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I hope I can put my thoughts here in words. Historically, there was a small upper class and a little bit larger middle class and a very large poor class. After Franklin Roosevelt and World War II, here in the United States, the middle class grew dramatically. I was one of them. I got a good education, and things moved on along. Then in the 70s and 80s and 90s, things started changing, and the middle class started getting smaller and smaller. And now we seem to be developing conflicts, because now we've tasted the good life, and now we're being excluded from it because of the, you know, like you say, the taxes and jobs moving elsewhere. Isn't that part of the economic change that's really going on? We've given people a chance, and now those chances seem to be diminishing.
Sure. I mean, I like to use the comparison. If you look back in the 60s, the biggest corporation was General Motors. And General Motors, basically workers for General Motors, got a middle-class standard of living. If you look at the average paycheck, it was equivalent to about $30,000 in today's dollars, which is, you know, was a decent income then, and still be a lot of workers would like to get that now. At the same time, that the although obviously executives were paid more, they weren't paid all that much more by today's standards. I think the CEO of General Motors in the 60s got paid something like $3 million adjusted, you know, in today's dollars. Now you look at the largest corporation, and if you like, well, you know, the quintessential American corporation today is Walmart. Walmart pays its employees an average of about $17,000 or $18,000. In many cases, no health benefits or minimal health benefits. CEO is paid something like last week we saw something like $17 million, and he's not by no means the highest paid CEO in the United States. We just got this huge surge of wealth at the top, and in many cases, you know, ordinary workers are worse off. Working class jobs no longer put you solidly, or in some cases at all, in the middle class. There's a lot of reasons for that, but the fact of it is something that we have to face up to. This is, yeah, there really has been a terrible blow to the idea of America as a middle class society.
Exactly. The point you're getting exactly to the point I'm saying. You're forcing people to take a view of life that's not something they really want, or not something that they thought was the American dream. It sounds to me like we're heading towards some serious problems.
Yeah, I'd say we're, you know, by the numbers, we look like we're back to the kind of levels of inequality that we had in the 20s. We're back to Great Gatsby. We're back to all of that, and it's a it's bad in multiple ways. It means, among other things, that the people running the country have no sense of how ordinary people live. They're just cut off from the reality of most people's lives, and the policies reflect that.
And I find it really interesting that somebody like Mr. Bush, who is in a very high level of economic income, has such a following with people who do not. And it just scratches my head how some people can buy into his thing, but yet he's not one of us. He is not one of us by any stretch of the imagination. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks.
I would point out that the interesting thing is that the Bush brothers don't actually have Texas accents. Kind of a curious thing about Bush. He made himself into a good old boy when he's actually basically a Connecticut Yaley upper class silver spoon baby. But anyway,
The comments of the caller make me think again about the kind of analysis. The sort of larger analysis of the great sweep of history, where people talk about different economic ages or periods where the economy is based in certain activities, and the move from an agrarian economy where pretty much everybody is farmers to we go to the industrial age when people start to go out and work in factories, to the place where either we are now or are coming out of this sort of economy that seems to either have this odd base of service and information, and then of course there's a lot of people who are making careers out of telling us what it is the next thing is.
And I
wonder what you think about that, and particularly about this point where we are now, and is the base of the economy, what is it changing into? Where is it going? Is this something we can do anything about?
Well, we're not going to go back, obviously, you know, think about this in stages. We're not going to go back to being an agrarian economy. Farmers are too productive for that. If 3 million farmers can feed the whole U.S. population, we're not going to be able to go back to having tens of millions of farmers. We're not going to go back to being a largely manufacturing economy. The U.S. manufacturing base is shrunken right now because we have this big trade deficit, and since we're going to have to get it back. So we probably should have about 3 million more people working in manufacturing than we do now, but that's still going to leave us a lot with a mostly service economy. But you know, the fact that, mostly what people do in our economy is services doesn't mean it has to be a low wage, polarized economy. The biggest sector in the United States pretty soon will be healthcare. Nothing that says that. Well, certainly doctors are well paid. There's nothing that says that nurses and healthcare support staff have to be badly paid. There's nothing that says that, as it's a law of nature, that Walmart employees have to be as badly paid. Imagine that we had a powerful union in the retail sector. Why couldn't you have middle class salaries being paid in there? So some changes are given to us by the march of history. That you got to have where we have to be a society that more and more is concentrated on producing services, intangibles rather than physical goods. That you can't stop. But it doesn't have to be a low wage economy in which most people live worse than their parents did, and a few people live incredibly well. It doesn't. That's a political choice, not an economic necessity.
All right, let's talk with another caller. Line 2, Champagne. Hello.
Yes, I just had a quick question. What is the effects? We hear so much about the government's debt and, you know, how bad the deficit is on international trade and how it deals with, like, adjusting taxes for everyone. Could you address the rising debt of just an average person, like under the age of 40, and this rising debt, the ripple effect of this come into play? Like you're analyzing everything with like the 20s. Well, the false security that people have with their own debt, could that cause a scare soon, or is there something that we could do to prevent such a scare from happening? You know, if the economy went bad.
Yeah. Okay. I can't offhand give you a number on the debt, implicit debt that people under 40 have, but it's quite a lot. I mean, basically, we're talking. Can I do this in my? You don't want me to try and do this on air to calculate it, Basically, we have promises to older Americans. You know, in addition, we've got the formal government debt. We've got the $3-point-something trillion of bonds out there. But we've also got the promises to people, you know, say my age, who have been paying into Social Security all our lives and are expecting to receive the benefits when we retire. That's an implicit debt that has to be paid out of the earnings of younger people. And same for Medicare. Now, how bad is it? I mean, the U.S. is a very rich country. It's got enormous ability to cope with things if it's well led. So the United States could, through a combination of sensible tax policy, sensible spending policy, it's going to be some pain in facing up to all this debt, but you can do it. And, you know, advanced countries do. There was a time, 15 years ago, Canada looked like it was in really big trouble in terms of its finances. And the Canadians just pulled up their socks, did what was necessary, and got the budget under control. We could do that in the United States, too, if we have good leadership. If we have a deadlock in which nobody is prepared to sacrifice any of their goals, then we can be in big trouble. Then you can have a situation in which we can't cope. That's kind of the Latin American thing. That it's not so much that they have had huge debts as that they when there's a crisis with the debt, when the financial markets start to lose confidence, there's no ability to compromise. The class divisions are too great to actually come up with an answer, and that's why all hell breaks loose. So if America was still the country it seemed to be 10 years ago, well, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, anyway, where we were able to get our act together and deal with things, I wouldn't be worried at all. As it is, I wonder, you know, basically, are we a banana republic? Have we turned into one when we weren't noticing?
I just have a follow-up to this. Do you think that the government can control the personal debts of the society and the personal debt of the society with the sort of instant gratification ideals that sort of, I would say, my generation, not the baby boomers, the one, the next, has, is what type of policies would you recommend the government to help get people more into a more stable lifestyle?
Okay, the personal debt, I think blaming the individuals for that is mostly unfair. We've had two things happen. First, some people have been borrowed. Well, a lot of the personal debt, it's not actually credit cards and all that. You know, yes, people get into trouble on that, but that's not a big deal. It's mostly people borrowing for houses. And part of that is we've had a bubble, I believe, in the housing market. And people got carried away, and that's very hard. But that's a temporary thing. It's going to be very unpleasant when it unwinds, but it's going to be temporary. But the other thing is, and this is where there's actually been research by Elizabeth Warren at Harvard Law School. She looks at where do bankruptcies come from, and they are not because people are splurging to buy big screen TVs and so on. They come because people are stretching themselves to buy houses in good school districts, and then something goes wrong and they find themselves in trouble. And that's not that is ultimately a failure of government. It's because people can no longer count on the public schools, and there's a diminishing number of school districts that people actually regard as being places where their kids will get a decent education. That's the source of the overstretch. And so I don't think the government is going to be able to – you don't want the government to go in there and tell people how to manage their personal finances, but you do want the government to create an environment in which ordinary American families can count on having a decent education for their kids, even if they don't happen to live in a fancy neighborhood.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really striking, it goes back to your earlier point about the bankruptcy bill, and also connects to the subject that you were talking about here when you were here last week. One of the things that emerged in this whole discussion around the bankruptcy bill was how many people ended up having to file for bankruptcy because they had enormous medical bills they couldn't pay.
That's right. And by the way, we are unique. I mean, the United States does some things better than other advanced countries and some things worse. And one of the things that we're completely unique on is the idea that society doesn't take responsibility if you have crushing medical bills. It's incredible that we have this situation in which even people who believe that they're solidly in the middle class, who've played by the rules, who've done everything right, if they have a medical emergency, it's very easy to find that all of your assets are gone and your insurance is canceled and you have and you find yourself in bankruptcy. And now with the new bankruptcy law, you find it very hard ever to get out of the bankruptcy.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers. I want to introduce again our guest, Paul Krugman. He is an op-ed columnist for The New York Times and has been for a number of years now. He's also professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. If you're interested, by the way, in sampling some of his columns that have appeared in The Times, there is a collection that's now available in paperback. It's titled The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. It is published by W.W. Norton, so you could go down to the bookstore and look for that. Questions here, welcome to. And we have a couple, several, in fact, probably more than we can get in, but we'll get in as many people as we can. In the time that we have left, we'll go next to a caller in Champaign County and line one. Hello.
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. But one aside is that it seems that Massachusetts healthcare reform ensures us that reveals to us that one of the laws of healthcare reform is that insurance companies and executives will never get any kind of parity to the nurses that work so hard in hospitals. In other words, dumping more money on the top of a very highly efficient system. But something struck me a while back about when you said that corruption was not a factor like it was in Indonesia. Well, I wonder how they score this. There's recently just been a study that supposedly shows that globalization correlates with transparency. And it just seems to me that the fact that Freeport-McMoRan has state takeover basically in Indonesia and is corrupting the corporation, ruled by the corporations for the corporations, and that's a quote from James Cramer at advocating buying that gold mining stock. that has so much sway, biggest single taxpayer in Indonesia. Don't they score, you know, the malfeasance of corporations, multinational or American, as part of the corruption on this side? Because, you know, it's not just happening just over there. I don't know.
It happens to some extent here, but there are differences, big differences of degree. I mean, the fact of the matter is that you can get through most of your business in the United States. Most people can get through the transactions they need to do in daily life without paying bribes, and that is not true in a lot of the world. Now, if the question is, are politicians effectively bought, at least on specific issues? Well, yeah, they are. So ours is a little bit there's not pervasive corruption through every part of society, and there are still occasionally actual honest politicians doing, or at least, you know, politicians who are honest on particular issues. I'm not saying that we're clean. You know, they're one of the most embarrassing things ever, and I'd say among economists, was when people like Larry Summers, the Treasury Secretary, lectured the Asian countries on what their problem is. They don't have honest corporate accounting, and we do. And then just 3 years later, along comes Enron. But there's still a difference. We're not completely gone yet. Of course, the answer to that sometimes is just we'll give it time.
Well, the point that I'm making, though, I accept your broader point, and we have sort of a corrupt but legal system of buying power and influence. But you know, but Freeport and all of the other corporations, even Halliburton, was charged with paying bribes in Nigeria for some kind of LNG plant, and we rarely hear about that. And I just wonder how they tote that up. Is that all, you know, Nigeria's fault for accepting the bribes and having a comprador government? That, you know,
no, of course, no. But that's somewhat sheared. But the fact of the matter is that you don't have to that. Corporations aren't paying bribes for everything they do in the United States, although they may be getting there. Look, I mean, I don't think we're really disagreeing here. It's not true. Let's put it this way. It's not true that Indonesia is corrupt only because the multinational corporations corrupted it. And the multinational corporations bribe a lot in Indonesia in part because that's the way the place works, but also they are corrupting influences themselves, and they do a little bit of the same thing here. So it's a continuum. We are not paragon, but we're not as far gone as some parts of the world, at least not yet.
We do seem to come off with the idea that we can decide who's transparent and who isn't, and then we have these huge scandals. I guess I should give over to the other callers.
Thank you. All right, well, thank you. Let's go to line three. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Did you say line three?
Yes.
Hello. I wanted to see my comment. I'm interested in your thought with respect to the housing bubble on the interdependence between the fiscal policy and the monetary policy. In other words, at this stage of the economic recovery, the extent to which additional tax cuts and fiscal deficits are wise and might be driving up the interest rates and then pricking the housing bubble and bringing the economy down.
Oof. How many hours do we have here? I'm reasonably convinced that there is a housing bubble. It's about a third of the country, but about two-thirds of the housing value is in regions where house prices have shot up enormously in the last 5 years, and you can explain part of that by low interest rates, but not enough. And so I think we really do have a situation where housing prices have gotten way out of line. That bubble is going to burst eventually, one way or another. It may actually be bursting as we speak. To some extent, the Federal Reserve is accelerating the bursting by raising interest rates. And my prediction actually is that the Fed will be backtracking in the not too long from now because they'll be trying, frankly, to offset the effects of declining housing. Budget deficits, they contribute to the interest rates. Although the fact of the matter is that we've got so much money flowing in from China and other Asian countries
that has, to a large extent, insulated us from the effects of the budget deficits at the cost of producing trade deficits, which is another problem that's waiting to explode on us one of these days. So the answer is, when people find themselves in trouble, having overstretched for houses and then finding they can't sell them for anything like what they paid for them, it might be politically tempting to say that's all Bush's fault, but I actually don't think it is. I think this is really just other stuff that's gone on.
All right.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to line two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. How do economists factor in the realities of ecology, the science of ecology, air and water pollution, soil erosion, succession, those kinds of things? Sometimes I feel like you all don't know about it, and I worry about that.
No, we know about it. At least economists know about it, and the whole chapter in my textbook about the whole issue of external costs. Sorry, a bit of economic jargon there, but about issues like pollution and effects on the environment. There's a strong case in economics for saying that people should be induced to take those costs into account, that you ought to have pollution taxes, restrictions, permits, and so on that make you take them into account. It's not in the GDP, but the GDP at every textbook, including mine, says gross domestic product is not a measure of human welfare. We use it for as a measure of economic activity. And if you wanted to measure how we're doing, you do want to take into account the effects on the environment. And just personally, I mean, I think, of course, environmental issues are ultimately the most important thing. It doesn't do you much good to have growing GDP if you end up losing the planet. And the scariest things that I see out there are, in fact, environmental consequences. I like my house in central New Jersey to be waterfront property, I guess, but I don't want to see it happen by drowning the eastern third of the state, which is what the forecasts say now will happen.
Okie doke. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Chicago. Line four. Hello.
I remember speaking to Kenneth Galbraith about 15 years ago about the matter of pension funds not being funded. And he said, sort of casually dismissed it, he said, don't worry about it. Well, today's pension funds have become a great concern and a worry about the future capacity of people to maintain their lifestyle and retirement and so forth. Do you have any views on the matter of pensions these days?
Well, corporate pensions have been...
And state government pension funds also.
Oh, yeah. Basically, everybody's been underfunding them, and so we have a real problem. And I would guess, and furthermore, the people who've gone for 401ks instead, they are wildly over-optimistic about what those are going to be worth. So we're going to have a pretty serious, Social Security is actually the piece of the system that's in pretty good shape. All the other pensions are in pretty serious shape. My guess is there'll be a bailout. I'd be astonished if there isn't. In the end, we're just going to have to bail out because there would be too many middle-class Americans who find themselves unable to retire. If you really want to study these things, Britain, in a lot of ways, went down the same route, but about 20 years ahead of us. And we can see they're already moving to basically bail out the retirement system because it's in a democracy, it's just intolerable that many people will be that badly hurt.
Other question. A number of years ago, I heard Alan Greenspan make a comment that he saw the economic bubble bursting back, when the electronic and the Silicon Valley expansion was so huge, and he said he could see that it was going to burst, but he decided he could do something about it, but he chose not to do something about it.
Don't get me started on Greenspan. He's done some good things, but he's made a lot of mistakes, and moral courage has not been his strong point.
We're coming to the point here. We're coming down to the end of the time, but there was something, and we don't really have enough time to talk about it very thoroughly. But in the comment about the fact that we may see government having to bail out private sector pension funds gets me at this looming crisis that people are talking about and say that we're not sufficiently planning for this enormous bill to pay our various kinds of social costs that are associated with the aging population, things like that, but pension funds, both public and private sector, Social Security, the cost of taking care of people, their health care, Medicare, Medicaid, and the long-term care costs that we're going to have, just a staggering bill that's going to come due pretty soon, and that we're really not ready for it, and we should have started getting ready for this decades ago, and we're not even getting ready for it now.
Well, there was this thing about putting money aside in the lockbox, which people made fun of Al Gore for saying, but was exactly right. The only thing to say is that the aging of the population is not as big an issue as people think. It's the medical costs. If medical costs would stop rising, we could deal, not easily, but with not too much difficulty, we could deal with the fact that the population is getting older. But we've got to do something about health care costs. That's what, when you see these forecasts that say it's going to be completely overwhelming, it's going to destroy the federal budget, what's really driving that is health care costs. Hmm. And we know it can be done because the United States spends twice as much on health care as most other advanced countries, and we get worse results. So it's really what we need is a reform of our healthcare system, and that would take off a lot of the urgency about dealing with the aging population.
Well, we're going to have to stop there with the mention that if folks, again, want to read more of the work of our guest, well, first of all, you look at the New York Times. Paul Krugman is op-ed columnist for the newspaper, has been since 1999. He has published a sampling of his columns from recent times in the book The Great Unraveling. It's now out in paper, published by W.W. Norton. He is also professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. And Professor Krugman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, is supported in part with funds from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Also, today's broadcast made possible with support from World Harvest Food, celebrating 6 years at 6th and University in Champaign with an anniversary tasting event.